The building and grounds boss at this church, Dan Ontko, and I have been talking to people in Texas about the replacement of the steeple, and we really feel that it's imperative that we make a decision quickly so that that order can be placed. So we would like to invite any member of the council, any member of the trustees, particularly those two groups, and any interested person in this church who wishes to attend, to be here tomorrow evening at 6 o'clock, which would give you a chance to have the rest of the evening ahead of you, so that we can talk over a couple of options we have and make a decision. So if you can come at 6 o'clock Monday evening, we would be happy to see you. The strange title for my sermon this morning comes from the English playwright Christopher Fry, who wrote this hopeful line: "The frozen misery of centuries breaks, cracks, begins to move." It's an image of an ancient, massive ice pack beginning to break up. And I would love to believe, even against the evidence, that it describes the future of religion, especially the Christian religion, and the distortions which for centuries have frozen the message of Christ into something cold and static. There's an old legend which changes that image but makes the same point. It's a fanciful story about the pipe Moses played while he was still a shepherd in the land of Midian. After he died, the story says, that rustic pipe was kept and treasured and became a religious relic. The only trouble was that for this kind of reverence, the pipe was thought after a while to be too plain. So workmen overlaid it with intricately wrought gold, and it was beautiful when they finished, held in the highest reverence, spoken of with the deepest respect. The only problem was that it could not be played anymore. The adornments had ruined its clear note. As a musical instrument, it had become useless. You are ahead of me already in seeing that as a parable of the way in which the fairly simple song of Jesus got overlaid with creeds and ritual until one could hardly hear the music of his real life anymore or be uplifted by its clear loveliness. The outside covering, the case, if you like, became so ornate and expensive to maintain that it took about all the energy most people had just to polish it and repair it when it cracked, and they hadn't much energy or time left over to recreate the old music. Let's try for a moment to define what that music is. If the right thing happens when you hear a sermon, love is rekindled in your heart for every man, woman, and child in the world. If you leave a sermon with your hatreds intact, if you go away with less regard for human life, the sermon has not been Christian, even if you have heard 100 verses quoted from Scripture. Because Christianity is a love relationship, first with the personality and message of Christ, and then by logical extension with other people. It rises above differences of creed or ways of worshiping. It hardly notices differences of language or color or class. It has far more patience with an honest atheist than with somebody who claims his religious truth is the only one and limits love to his own narrow circle. Every church contains some valuable truth, but not a single one contains all truth. Each one mirrors something of Christ, but none have caught him whole. That's why, as people grow in knowledge, they sometimes pass from one church to another to fulfill their needs, just as students pass from one grade in school to another. But all through that passage, our obligation is to respect one another, even when we differ. We try to remember that a person's church is nearly always emotionally determined, at least at first. Most of us are what our parents were, or we are drawn to a church because we like the music, or the sanctuary, or the minister, or because we have friends there. And having chosen like that, it makes no sense to feel superior to someone else for having chosen differently. The one essential in Christianity is loving an ideal so much that the love spills over on people around us. And if a Quaker finds help in silence, and the Baptist in total immersion, if the Catholic finds it in the Mass, and the Episcopalian likes incense and ceremony, and the Methodist puts her emphasis on personal experience and the hymns of Wesley, then let's be grateful that for every kind of personality there is some road that leads to ultimate truth. But about truth, I want to say something so important that I hope I can say it well. Truth has meaning for you only as it authenticates itself in your own experience. I'll try to show you what I mean. You cannot believe something is true just because you are told to believe it, or even because you want to. You may pretend you do in order to be part of the group, or because you are intellectually lazy, or a little bit dishonest, but you can't really do it. You remember that quotation from Alice in Wonderland when the Queen claims she is 101 years, 5 months, and 1 day old? "I can't believe it," Alice tells her. "Can't you?" says the Queen. "Try again. Draw a long breath and shut your eyes." And I think that's what ministers say to people sometimes. Take a long breath, close your eyes tightly, and believe each argument I make about doctrine, even if some of it is improbable, perhaps even because it's improbable. There are people, church-going people, who really do feel that the harder a thing is to believe, the more credit one gets for believing it. But that's not the kind of real conviction that has power to change your life. And let me try to illustrate what it's like when something you have sort of agreed on suddenly becomes something you really believe in. Take the matter of loving your father. For years you heard you ought to, accepted the idea that you did. It was a given, something to be taken for granted. Of course, I love my dad. It never occurred to you to question the proposition, or if it did, in a moment of anger, you felt guilty and ashamed and quickly pushed the ugly face of doubt back into the sand. But then one day, something happens. He does something and suddenly stands before you in a new light. Or you have a crisis and he supports you in ways you had not even imagined. And all of a sudden, what had been a proposition becomes a fact. The reality of love surprises you. You have to talk about it. Do you know what my dad did? I remember the day during my freshman year in college, 500 miles from home, when my father did something so wonderfully unselfish that I entered a whole new world in my relationship with him. That is what I mean by truth authenticating itself. It's a lot like falling in love. Nobody has to tell you that you are in love. Some preacher lecturing you on your condition would be an unbearable nuisance. You don't need him to tell you what love is. You want to go and tell everybody else what it is. Every lover becomes an apostle. That's how it was with the first followers of Christ. They found certain truths born into their minds from watching, from talking with him, from experiences they shared in his company. Those truths became their creed. But the creed was not imposed by Christ as a prior condition. Listen carefully. The creed was not imposed by Christ as a prior condition of friendship and following. And this is how it has to be, always, because no truth has any value until we see it to be true and receive it as a possession of our own minds and hearts. And yet I have heard distinguished and thoughtful people, hungry for what Christ can give, brushed off by guardians of orthodoxy because they said, for example, that they had a problem with the story of the walk on water or the revival of Lazarus from the dead. I would say to such an honest person, thank God for evidence of a mind at work. Come on in and let's study and experience lead you into your own personal convictions. We've reversed things. Jesus did not say to anyone, if you believe I was born of a virgin, you can be my disciple. In fact, he never mentioned his birth at all. Never. He simply said, come and walk with me. And later, some who walked with him came to believe that only a miraculous birth could explain such a man, and some didn't. And there is never even a hint from him that that was a crucial element in their relationship. I used to pose a problem for my fundamentalist students in a course I taught at the university called The Bible as Literature. I would talk about Albert Schweitzer, his renunciation of fame and money, his devotion to the poor and sick and ignorant, his claim that he went to tropical Africa in direct response to the command of Christ, whom he acknowledged as the Lord of his life. And then I would ask, do you think this man was a Christian? And given that sketch of a life remarkably like the life of Jesus himself, they would respond that Schweitzer probably was the most faithful Christian of the 20th century. And then I would tell them that this man who changed his life in obedience to Christ did not read literally the story of the virgin birth or the sensational miracles that defied natural law. And they didn't know what to say, because belief in those propositions had been called crucial by their churches. And yet here was a life so superior to any other they knew that it seemed sheer madness to call it non-Christian. Christianity, in the end, is a relationship. And a relationship does not depend on our believing any story ever told about our friend by somebody else, but only on whether we love our friend and find ourselves transformed in his or her presence. I can tell you that I came into the church because my friends and family were there, and it was the thing to do. But I remained in the church after I was grown because I came to know about people like Schweitzer, a man I knew. Once said, well, Albert Schweitzer thinks the story of the virgin birth is poetry rather than literal history. So Albert Schweitzer cannot be a Christian. I looked at the man and thought of all I knew about his life and remembered the judgment of Jesus: by their fruits you shall know them. And decided that my test would be the practical one Jesus described. The man I was talking to was absolutely indistinguishable from the most greedy, aimless, and selfish people in our town. The German doctor he made fun of had given up everything most of us prize to follow Christ into a steaming jungle. If I had a divine commission to know them by their fruits, I knew which one to call a Christian. When we look at a life like that, or even hear about it, we feel the same kind of conviction by which we know that dawn on the Grand Canyon on a perfect morning is as beautiful as anything on earth. No one has to tell us. In fact, some intruding idiot at your shoulder declaiming breathlessly how beautiful it is will probably spoil it and make you want to run from him before the spell is broken. No argument in all the world, however plausible, can possibly produce in you the same conviction that comes when you actually experience the canyon. When that happens, the outward beauty meets an inward recognition, and in your heart you know. Knowledge deep and true and lasting. And I am saying that Christianity never means, deeply and truly means very much, until exactly that same kind of thing happens to you. A day comes when life abruptly changes its voice. Someone you love goes away forever, and you are left to sift memories and meditate on what those memories mean. A long illness brings you into such deep shadow that you feel the chill and doubt to see the sun or feel a leaf again. But you get well, and suddenly the world means something it never meant before. It can happen in so many ways. Through a new friendship, a rapturous love, an exciting new challenge, or even through that inexorable process by which life slows us down, touches our heartbeat, teaches us what it means to grow older and think new thoughts, and then religion may abruptly become truly relevant. All those years of sermons and ceremonies begin to show meanings we had never recognized. As one woman here said to me recently, even the public reading of Scripture becomes something to attend to carefully. For out of that ages-old wisdom, something is actually being said. I suppose what we really try to do in churches is hold you until something like this happens to you. Maybe that's what the talking and the music and the prayers and the friendships are all about. Ways of holding you until all of a sudden the whole thing comes together in a flash of light and you know, really know what it all means. I'm willing to admit that for me, anyway, this is probably what my ministry ultimately means. The words chosen carefully, the ideas constantly varied, the seed patiently sown, all in the hope that sooner or later, for some of us, there will come the meaning that is deeper than all other meanings. Until then, together, we wait.